Some of you have been to the worship service already this morning, some of you haven't. We sang a hymn this morning. The hymn was Victory in Jesus. And there's no reason you should know this, but when I sing that hymn, I see a dusty area outside of a building where there's dust on the floor. I see trees that look a little different from the trees around here, and I see people of Tanzania. Because we sang this hymn every day for almost 12 days while we were in Tanzania, over 10 years ago. And I simply commend to you hymns that to you, when you sing them, bring back memories of times when you've had a chance to serve and to do things that were a little different, a little unusual. I don't know if hymns make that kind of connection to you, but they do to me. We've been at Exodus for a little while, and we have finally come to Exodus 19. We got a start on this last week. We're going to do a little bit more today and begin to move into a study of the Ten Commandments. I want to try this morning to give you a more general sense, widen a bit the foundation and the context for our study. So I'd like to begin with this. When people say the law, in the context of Christianity or in the context of Judaism or in the context of the Bible, what do they mean? Okay, they mean a lot of things, but one of the things they mean is the first five books. So when we pick out the Ten Commandments from the middle of Exodus, we are not really getting the whole, we're getting the heart. We're not getting all of it, we're getting the heart of it. The context in which this is set is the first five books of the Bible. If you take a look at the places where the Ten Commandments appear, they appear both in Exodus and in Deuteronomy. If you take a look in Deuteronomy chapter 5, there's a place in chapter 5 in Deuteronomy where they come. Why do they come in Deuteronomy? I'm hoping a couple of you will know. You've been in here long enough, you got a chance. Why are the Ten Commandments given in Deuteronomy as well as in Exodus? Because the generation that originally heard is now gone, and a new generation has come, and that new generation needs to hear this again. Deuteronomy has a very special meaning. Some of you know that I do a little bit of science in the time that I'm not with you. There is an element that has one of its isotopes called deuterium. The element is hydrogen. One of its isotopes is called deuterium. Why is it called deuterium? Because it's a second form of hydrogen. Deutero means the second of something. So Deuteronomy means the second giving of the law. The law has been given to the original group that came out of Egypt. They've mostly died out. Their descendants are now there. The law is given a second time. The implication that the law has to be renewed in the hearts of the next generation is something that's implicit in the first five books of the Bible. Now, the giving of the law came just after the children of Israel had been delivered from slavery in Egypt. And I want to make sure that you understand what's happening here, so let me try to put it this way. God is demonstrating to the people both His love and His power. God is demonstrating both His love and His power. He demonstrates His love in bringing them out. He demonstrates in His power in how He brings them out. He demonstrates His love in gathering them together and giving them a sense of His presence. He demonstrates His power in how He does that. So what I'd like to do this morning is I'd like to read through part of what's here in Exodus 19. And try to make a context. Before the day is over, I hope we will have talked at least about things that are as far out as Exodus 32. So we're going to look at some fairly wide sections here. Time out for just a minute. Some of you are new to our group, and I want to remind you, I do have a recorder. Sometimes it works. When it works, I post the recordings on the internet, and the internet address is on the board there, so if you want to hear, we actually did the Ten Commandments about 3 years ago, 2 years ago, something like that. And those lessons are up. And what we're doing now is essentially going through that material again. My sense is you don't remember well enough that this is a problem. So, and if you do remember, then it gets reinforced, and that's good as well. Okay, so Exodus 19, verse 2, setting out from Rephidim, they reached the desert of Sinai, pitched camp in the desert there facing the mountain. Verse 3, Moses then went up to God, for the Lord had called to him from the mountain, saying, say this to the house of Jacob, tell the Israelites, you have seen for yourselves what I did to the Egyptians, and how I carried you away on eagle's wings and brought you to me. And now, if you are really prepared to obey me and keep my covenant, you out of all peoples shall be my personal possession, for the whole world is mine. For me, you will be a kingdom of priests, a holy nation. Those are the words you are to say to the Israelites. So Moses went and summoned the people's elders and acquainted them with everything that the Lord had bidden him. And the people all replied with one accord, whatever the Lord has said, we will do. Moses then reported to the Lord what the people had said. Now, we could stop there if we wanted to, but the Bible doesn't. What has just happened? Moses has been called up the mountain. God has spoken to him. And what are God's instructions? You just read it. What are God's instructions? Go back down and tell the people this. Okay? And when Moses went back down and told the people that, what did the people say? We'll do it. Now, this is maybe not perfect, but it's close. There's a friend of mine who, in his older years, he is by no means old, but in his older years, he's had a pretty full career. He gave up the career that he had had. He took retirement. And he went to work in an inner city school, middle school, teaching middle school history and coaching basketball. Best player in the school is a kid, let's call him Clyde. That's not his name, but let's call him Clyde. And Clyde is ineligible to play because Clyde has not worked in his academics. And he told me that in a game over the fall, they were playing a game, getting whipped. And Clyde is in the stands. And my friend, the coach, said, I just stood and I looked at Clyde. And I looked out of the court and I looked back at Clyde. He said, the next day, another teacher said, Clyde's never going to be eligible to play. And he went and he talked to Clyde and he said, you're in seventh grade. You got your life ahead of you. You got a chance to do this, and it can open so many doors, it's not funny. A teacher has said, you're never going to be eligible to play. What are you going to do? What do you think Clyde said? Clyde said, oh, I'm going to work hard. I'm going to do it. Right there, everything hangs in the balance. Can you feel it? Right there, everything hangs in the balance. What's Clyde really going to do? Be careful with your answer. What's Clyde going to do? We don't know. It's all hanging in the balance. God has said to Moses, go tell this to the people. He tells the people, what do the people say? We're going to do it. Are they going to do it? It's all hanging in the balance. It's all hanging in the balance. Now, some of you who are answering correctly, I'm ignoring you right now. Because there is enough to the story to know. But I'm walking a tightrope this morning because I'm trying to say two very different things, and they are both true, and they are mutually and almost totally contradictory. Let's keep going. Verse 9. The Lord then said to Moses, look, I will come to you in a dense cloud so that the people will hear when I speak to you and will believe you ever after. What's the implication? Until I do this, they may not believe you. Moses then told the Lord what the people had said. Moses then said to the Lord then said to Moses, this is verse 10, go to the people and tell them to sanctify themselves today and tomorrow. They must wash their clothes and be ready for the day after tomorrow. For the day after tomorrow, in the sight of all the people, the Lord will descend on Mount Sinai. You will mark out the limits of the mountain and say, take care not to go up to the mountain, nor to touch the edge of it. Anyone who touches the mountain will be put to death. No one may lay a hand on him. He must be stoned or shot by an arrow. Whatever man or beast, he will not live. When the ram's horn sounds a long blast, they must go up to the mountain. What you have just seen is God demonstrating his power, and his power is awesome. God is going to demonstrate his power, and his power is awesome. There are consequences for ignoring what God says. Moses came down from the mountain to the people. He made the people sanctify themselves. They washed their clothes. He said to the people, be ready for the day after tomorrow. Verse 16, at daybreak 2 days later, there were peals of thunder and flashes of lightning, dense cloud on the mountain, and a very loud trumpet blast. And in the camp, all the people trembled. Moses led the people out of the camp to meet God, and they took their stand at the bottom of the mountain. Mount Sinai was entirely wrapped in smoke because the Lord had descended on it in the form of fire. In a way, the people shouldn't have been surprised. How had they been led? How had they been led out in the wilderness? Cloud by day, fire by night, right? But there's a whole lot more of it now. Some more things are said here that basically repeat all the warnings. And chapter 20 comes, verse 1. In my translation, there are six words and a period. Chapter 20, verse 1 opens in my translation with six words and a period. There's a six-word sentence. Does yours have a period pretty early? Let me read what I have. Then God spoke all these words. One word, one name for the Ten Commandments is the Decalogue. Have you heard that word? Have you heard that term? Deca is, I think, Latin for ten, and log or logos is Greek or Latin for word. Sometimes the Ten Commandments are called the Ten Words. It isn't ten words, but ten statements, if you will. So here it goes. He said, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt where you lived as slaves. And there is a silent, unspoken, unwritten word here. The word is therefore. Or the word is thus, or the word is so. Because I have done this. Now, here's what I want from you. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt where you lived as slaves. You will have no other gods to rival me. You will not make yourselves a carved image or any likeness of anything in heaven above or on earth beneath or in the water under the earth. You will not bow down to them or serve them. And it goes on. This is the speaking of the Ten Commandments. All right, you have read through the end of Exodus, right? That was your assignment. So you've read this. I want you to skip down to verse 18. We're going to come back and look at these one at a time in the weeks to come. But come down to verse 18. My translation only has the word seeing. I think you could include hearing if you want to, or feeling if you want to, as other terms that could be used here. Mine says, seeing the thunder pealing, the lightning flashing, the trumpet blasting, and the mountain smoking, the people were all, mine says, terrified. And kept their distance. Not much problem obeying that keep your distance when you are terrified. Let me repeat it. Seeing the thunder pealing, the lightning flashing, the trumpet blasting, and the mountain smoking, the people were all terrified. Verse 19, speak to us yourself, they said to Moses, and we will obey, but don't let God speak to us, you can almost hear the word again, or we're going to die. Moses said to the people, don't be afraid. There's a place in Psalms or Proverbs that says the beginning of wisdom is what? The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. What's the next thing after you realize how awesome God is? Somebody starts to say to you, now, You understand how fearsome God is. Now don't be afraid. Do you feel a tension? Do you feel that conflict I'm talking about? Be afraid, and don't be afraid all at the same time. If you ever lose your fear of the Lord, nothing works. If you don't get past fear to recognize God's love, nothing works either. It's a paradox. Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid. God has come to test you, so that your fear of Him being always in your mind may keep you from sinning." Now, what has happened? God has come to the people. He has told them the principles by which He wants them to live. And He has shown His power in ways that terrify the people. The people have now been invited to the other side of that fear. But that's where things hang. I want to take you for just a moment to Luke chapter 12. So hold your place here. I want to take you to Luke chapter 12. Jesus is speaking. Verse 4. If you look at verse 1, the people had gathered in their thousands so that they were treading on one another. And He began to speak first of all to His disciples. I want you to sense this. There are thousands crowded around, and Jesus is speaking to His disciples in the witness where the crowds can see Him. So verse 4, "To you, my friends, I say, don't be afraid of those who kill the body and afterwards can do no more. I'll tell you who you ought to fear. Fear him who, after he has killed, has the power to cast into hell. Yes, I tell you, he is the one to fear." And then, look at what follows. "Can you not buy 5 sparrows for 2 pennies? And not one is forgotten in God's sight. Every hair on your head has been counted. There is no need to be afraid. You are worth more than many sparrows." What do you hear put together in this verse? The fear of the Lord. And once that's established and permanently set, then what? Then move past that fear into a relationship with Him. That's hard. You're going to forget the one, or you never make it to the other. The Bible uses the word awe, and I think that may be better for us. I think it has a higher tone to it, but it's still there. And the Bible, I don't think, minces words too much. That fear is not an improper word to use for the front end. If you look at the book of Isaiah has the same number of chapters as there are books in the Bible. If you go to the 39th chapter you've been reading, why you should be fearing God, and starting in chapter 40, which corresponds to the New Testament count, you suddenly hear Isaiah begin to say, "Don't be afraid, don't be afraid." It begins to show you God's love. The beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. But if that's only the beginning, there's deeper knowledge that's coming. Turn to Hebrews chapter 12. Maybe. Fear meaning awe. And afraid meaning something else. Hebrews chapter 12.
Out of Matthew yesterday, this was one of the questions about who is Jesus referring to when he speaks about fearing the one who can destroy both body and soul.
And what answer did you write down?
I referenced Isaiah and Hebrews.
Hebrews chapter 12, verse 18. What do we say about Deuteronomy?
Second
giving of the law. The first generation has died off. You got another generation, they need to know. Here we are in Hebrews, hundreds of years later. Probably 1,000 and some years later. And what do we read starting in verse 18? We read a picture of what just happened in Exodus 19. What you have come to, not what they came to, what you have come to, is nothing known to the senses. It is not a blazing fire or gloom or total darkness or storm or trumpet blast or the sound of a voice speaking that made everyone hear it beg that no more should it be said to them. He's looking back and saying, you're coming to something else than what the people in Exodus came to. They couldn't bear the order that was given. The whole scene, verse 21, was so terrible that Moses said, I am afraid and trembling. What you've come to is Mount Zion and the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, where millions of angels have gathered for the festival with the whole church of firstborn sons enrolled as citizens of heaven. You have come to God Himself, the supreme judge, and to the spirits of the upright who have been made perfect. And to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, who's pleading, and to purifying blood, which pleads more insistently than Abel's. Make sure you never refuse to listen when he speaks. Verse 28, we have been given possession of an unshakable kingdom. Let us therefore be grateful and use our gratitude to worship God in the way that pleases him. And it's got two words. What are the two words? Reverence and fear or awe. Do you feel those contradictions, those paradox pieces coming together? Our primary motivation for worship ought to be what? Love and gratitude. But God knows us and He knows how we work. So He gave us a second motivation. What's that? Fear at all. And it's when those work together properly. So let's go back now and look at Exodus 20. Verse 20. Do not be afraid. God has come to test you so that your fear of Him, always in your mind, may keep you from sinning. Okay. Now, I want you to notice in verse 21, there's something hidden in verse 21 that everything that's been going on is so echoing in your mind, you almost miss it. Picture what has happened so far. And again, the Bible doesn't worry much as much about chronology as we do, but I think this is probably close to chronological. Moses has gone up the mountain. Moses has come back down the mountain, told the people what God said. What God said was, prepare, because I'm coming in a way that all of you see me and all of you hear me. And God does that. What do the people say? You go find out what He wants. Come back and tell us. We don't want to hear that again. It's going to kill us if we hear that again. Verse 21. So the people kept their distance while what happened? While Moses, mine says, approached the dark cloud where God was. Where was that dark cloud? On the mountain. Where did Moses go? Back up the mountain. Okay? How long is he there? You may not know this. You've just read it, I know, but you may not know this. He's there until about chapter 24. He's there until about chapter 24. Okay? And what's he doing? Verse 22, the Lord said to Moses. When did he say to Moses? Presumably when Moses got up the mountain far enough that they could talk. Tell the Israelites this. And what he does is he begins to repeat some of the things he said. He begins to amplify some of the things he said. And what you have here is this is the widening of the law. The 10 words have come. The Ten Commandments have come. Now he's widening it. And what does he do? He begins to talk about. Chapter 21 talks about slaves. Verse 12 talks about murder. Verse 18 talks about fighting and assaults and blows and wounds. The end of 21, the start of 22, starts to talk about theft of animals. One of the things about blows and wounds, take a look at verse 23, 24, and 25 in chapter 21. Does this sound familiar? What's in that stands out?
Eye for an eye.
Eye for an eye. Now, it's not just eye for eye. What else does it say?
Tooth
for tooth. Hand for hand. Life for life. Okay, that the Old Testament law. Remember when Jesus came and in the Sermon on the Mount, what did he say? You've heard it said, but I say to you, and Jesus began to dig deeper into what was there. Okay, the connections are here. You keep going, and there's all this stuff that's there. And when he comes to the end of chapter 23 and starts into chapter 24, God begins to say something else. Look at chapter 24, first couple of verses. He, that is God, then said to Moses, come up to the Lord, you and Aaron and Nadab and Abihu and 70 of the elders of Israel, and bow down at a distance. Moses alone will approach, the others will not approach, nor will the people come up with him. Moses went and told the people all of God's words and all of his laws. All the people answered with one voice. This is the end of verse 3 of chapter 24. What do the people say? Everything you've said, we're going to do. Moses put all of the Lord's words into... Does yours have that? I'm looking at the start of verse 4. Moses put all of the Lord's words into writing. Yours may say Moses wrote down all of these. And early the next morning he built an altar. He sent certain Israelites, young Israelites, to offer burnt offerings and sacrifice bullocks to the Lord. He took half the blood and put it into basins. The other half he sprinkled on the altar. Taking the book of the covenant, what he's written down so far, he read it to the listening people, who then said, this is tail end of verse 7. What'd they say? We will do everything the Lord has said. We will obey. Here's Clyde. Hang in the moment. Moses then took the blood, sprinkled it over the people. This is the blood of the covenant which the Lord has made with you, entailing all these stipulations. I love the way my translation gave that. Verse 9 and 10, Moses, Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, and 70 elders of Israel went up, and they saw the God of Israel, beneath whose feet there was what looked like a sapphire pavement, as pure as the heavens themselves. But he did no harm to the Israelite notables. They actually gazed on God, and then they ate and drank. The Lord then said to Moses, come to me on the mountain, stay there, and I will give you the stone tablets, the law and the commandments which I have written for their instructions. Moses made ready with Joshua his assistant, and they went up the mountain. He said to the elders, wait here for us until we come back to you. You have Aaron and Ur with you. If anyone has any matter to settle, let them go with them. Go to them. And Moses went up the mountain. What did all the other elders do, and what did Aaron do, and these other leaders they mentioned? This wasn't supposed to be a very hard question. Do your best. They stayed behind. Where did they stay? Chances are they didn't stay right where they were standing. Chances were they went back down the mountain with the people. Okay? Chapter 25, chapter 26, chapter 27, 28, 29, 30, 31. All the way across here, Moses is getting law from the Lord. Most of this, interestingly enough, is not talking about wounds and assault and murder and rape and things of that sort. Now he's talking about how do you worship? How do you come before me to worship? That's the subject of chapter 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31. More on how to worship than there was on how to get along with each other. Everybody notice that? Look at the last verse. I'm going to jump around just a little bit for this, but the last verse of chapter 31, what does he say? Chapter 31, I think it's verse 18. Mine says, when he, that is God, had finished speaking to Moses on Mount Sinai, what did he do? Gave him the two tablets of the testimony, tablets of stone inscribed by the finger of God. Ten Commandments were written on two tablets of stone, and boy, is that an iconic picture, right? You've seen that picture. Cecil B. DeMille showed it to you, if nobody else. Now, let's go back, and I want to pick up two or three little things. If you take a look at chapter 25, that's where the section started, right? Verse 17. Well, my translation says, you will also make a mercy seat of pure gold. What does yours call what my translation calls mercy seat?
Atonement
cover. Okay. What's it supposed to be made of? How big is it supposed to be? Longer this way, shorter that way. Rectangular. Back up to verse 10. You must make me an ark of acacia wood of certain dimensions that the cover matches. See, making a box and a top for the box. Back up to verse 8. Make me a sanctuary so that I can reside among you. Your translation may say tabernacle, because that word, some translations say tabernacle. This was a portable structure, mostly with curtains made of either skins or linen or something like that, poles that could be carried along, and then when you get to a new place, you set this back up. This was their worship center all the way across this time. Not until the temple was built by Solomon did they have anything different. This is what they had. All right? So, build me a sanctuary. Inside the sanctuary, fit me an ark. Inside for the ark, fit me a cover. Mercy seat cover. You see that? Okay. He talks about what the mercy seat cover is supposed to, what the mercy seat or the atonement cover is supposed to look like. Verse 21, you will put the atonement cover or the mercy seat on top of the ark, and inside the ark you will put the testimony which I am about to give you. What's that testimony? Chapter 31, verse 18. Supposed to put the two tablets, right? That's what's supposed to go in there. Verse 22. What does it say? I'm not sure there's a much more important verse in this whole section. I've underlined this verse. A couple of things I've underlined more than once to make sure I see those words. There. Where? On the mercy seat. Or at the mercy seat. I will come to meet you from above the mercy seat, from between the two winged creatures which are on the Ark of the Testimony, I will give you all my orders for the Israelites. Okay. Time out for just a minute. What's happened? Moses has gone up on the mountain. He's got a couple of chapters worth of instructions for how do people get along with each other. How do you deal with murder? How do you deal with assault? How do you deal with theft? How do you deal with rape? How do you deal with all those other problems? Right? How do you deal with property problems? A couple of chapters for that. Then he gives him, not a couple of chapters, but a couple of chapters, about twice as much, on how do you worship. And the worship instructions are very specific. You're going to make me this, and you're going to make it this way. You're going to make me this, you're going to make it this way. You're going to make me this, you're going to make it this way. Go to Hebrews, and what it says is, God showed him the heavenly actuality and said, now you make me models for earth of this. He's giving him instructions. What's Moses' job? To do it. To do it how? That way. And when that happens, verse 22, what will God do? God will now meet with you. Okay, God will meet with you there. When you have done all the things that I've said to do, which involves the people, Moses can't do this on his own. When you've done all those things, then I will meet with you, and in that place, from above the mercy seat, from above the atonement cover, I will give you my instructions, my orders for the Israelites. There comes a point two chapters later where all of this happens. Exactly that way. And I want you prepared for that when that day comes. But I want to now step back to the larger truth. You go to Hebrews, and Hebrews said Moses was shown the reality in heaven and was asked to build models on earth. Whose blood goes onto the mercy seat cover? The blood of bulls and other animals that have been sacrificed. Whose blood goes on the atonement cover that's in heaven? Jesus' blood. How many times do the bulls have to be sacrificed on earth for this to happen? Recurring over and over and over again. Jesus once. Can I put it together for you from last week? If you weren't here last week, you are in trouble. You won't know what I'm talking about. How many times do you strike the rock and water will come? Once. After that, what do? You speak. Here's the atonement cover. The bulls are going to die, and they're going to die, and they're going to die, and their blood's going to be brought, and their blood's going to be brought, and their blood's going to be brought. But when Jesus dies, the heavenly reality happens, and the channels are open. You call it an atonement cover. There are people who cleverly, I think, but also accurately, take the word atonement and start dividing it up. At one with. What Jesus does by his death is to open up a channel of communication that otherwise could not be there. And that is being modeled for us in what's happening with the people. Okay. I want you to look at chapter 25, last verse. This has no theological significance except to try to tie together the things I've just told you. What does it say? Make sure that you work. Mine says, see that you work according to the pattern. Mine says, to the design. Keep going. Shown to you on the mountain. Would you take a look at chapter 26, verse 30? Yours calls it the tabernacle. Mine calls it the dwelling. My translation calls it the dwelling. This is how you must erect the dwelling. This is how much you must set up the dwelling following the design that you saw on the mountain. Verse 30. Chapter 27, verse 8. Don't worry about the first half of the verse. Look at the last half of the verse. You're going to make it the way you were shown on the mountain. Okay. Now, there's a lot more in here, but I want to take you to this last little piece. Chapter 31, verse 12. Chapter 31, verse 12. How are we doing on time? Maybe this is working. The Lord then said to Moses, speak to the Israelites and say, you will keep my Sabbaths properly, for this is a sign between myself and you for all the generations to come, so that you will know that it is I, the Lord, who sanctifies you. Verse 16, the Israelites will keep the Sabbath, observing the Sabbath for all their generations to come. This is an eternal covenant between myself and the Israelites, a sign forever. There are five covenants that God makes with people during the Old Testament that give us signs for the way God relates to us. This is one of those. The Moses covenant talks about boundaries and laws. But what's the sign? The sign is the Sabbath. Keeping the Sabbath. Obedience in the Sabbath. Okay. Most people think it's circumcision. It's not. The sign is the Sabbath. And this is where you see that sign. Okay. So, here is Moses having the spiritual high of spiritual highs. God has written the Ten Commandments on tablets of stone. He has given him detailed instructions for the people. What have the people said? Hanging in the balance. You go up there, find out whatever's going on. You come back, tell us whatever he says, we'll do it. He's already said what? I only read two of them. What did he say? No other gods before me? No graven images, right? No, a bunch of other stuff. Chapter 32. When the people saw that Moses was a long time before coming down the mountain, how long was he up on the mountain? Anytime you're thinking about times in the Bible, think about 40. 40 years in the wilderness, 40 days, 40 nights, right? He was up there 40 days and 40 nights. When they saw that he was a long time before coming down the mountain, they gathered round Aaron and said to him, "Get to work." Does yours say it that way? That's a quote from my translation. "Get to work. Make us a god to go at our head, for that Moses, the man who brought us here from Egypt, we don't know what's become of him. Strip off the gold rings and the ears of your wives and your sons and your daughters." Looked like they had piercings in those days. "Bring them to me." The people all stripped off the gold rings from their ears and brought them to Aaron. He received what they gave it, melted it down in the mold, and with it made the statue of a calf. "Israel," the people shouted, "here is your God who brought you out of Egypt." Observing this, Aaron built an altar before the statue and made this proclamation, "Tomorrow will be a feast in the Lord's honor." Early the next morning, they sacrificed burnt offerings and brought communion sacrifices. The people sat down to eat and drink and afterwards got up to amuse themselves. I love that phrase.
To play.
The Lord then said to Moses, where was the Lord and where was Moses? This is verse 7. They're up on the mountain. Getting instructions for what? How to properly worship God. What were the first two words? First two commandments, no other gods before me, and especially no idols. Okay, what's happened so far? It hasn't been 40 days, and they've smashed the first two. The Lord then said to Moses, "Go down at once, for your people whom you brought." Is that right? Am I quoting this correctly? "Your people whom you brought from Egypt have become corrupt. They have quickly left the way which I ordered them to follow. They have cast themselves a metal calf, worshipped it, and offered sacrifice to it." The Lord then said to Moses, "I know these people. I know how obstinate they are. Leave me now so that my anger can blaze at them and I can put an end to them. I'll make a great nation out of you instead." Whoa. Don't miss this one. Moses tried to pacify the Lord his God. "Lord," he said, "why should your anger blaze at the people?" Think about what the Egyptians would say. "Remember your servants, Abraham and Isaac and Jacob." Can you skip as fast as I can skip? Are you moving with me? Are you moving with me through this? Think about the Egyptians. What were they going to say? "Remember your servants, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to whom you swore by your very self, making them this promise." Verse 14, the Lord then relented over the disaster which he had intended to inflict on his people. And Moses turned and came down the mountain with two tablets of the testimony in his hands, tablets inscribed on both sides, inscribed on the front and on the back. The tablets were the work of God. The writing on them was God's writing engraved on the tablets. When Joshua heard the noise of the people shouting, he said to Moses, "There's the sound of a battle in the camp." Pause for just a minute. Who said that?
Joshua.
I thought Moses was alone on the mountain. Where'd Joshua come from? Oh, no, you heard it this morning and you've forgotten it. He was Moses' adjutant or assistant or aide. He didn't, I don't know if he went all the way with God, but he was waiting on Moses on the mountain. So Joshua has no idea what's going on back down here. And he says, "Sounds like the noise of a battle in camp." The people went to amuse themselves. It sounds like they're fighting. But Moses replied, "No song of victory is this sound. No lament for defeat this sound." And as he approached the camp, verse 19, he saw the calf and the groups dancing. Moses blazed with anger. He threw down the tablets he was holding, shattering them at the foot of the mountain, seized the calf they had made and burned it, grinding into powder which he scattered on the water and made the Israelites drink it. And Moses said to Aaron, "What have these people done to you for you to have brought so great a sin on them?" Notice it goes to Aaron and back out. What have these people done to you for you to have brought so great a sin on them? You should have been the one to say, "What are you talking about? Wait on the Lord. Wait on the Lord." And you didn't say that. And Aaron replied, "My Lord should not be so angry. You yourself know what a bad state these people are in. They said to me, 'Make a God to go at our heads, for that Moses, the man who brought us here out of Egypt, we don't know what's become of him.' I then said to them, 'Anyone with gold, strip it off,' and they gave it to me, and I threw it in the fire, and out came this calf." You gotta laugh for a moment, but golden calves just don't come rolling out. Can I tell you that 1,000 years after this, maybe it's 600 years after this, there is a person that God said, "If you obey me, I will make you as great as David." And the man didn't do it. Instead, he set up a rival altar in another place. And you know what he put on that altar? Golden calves. 600, 1,000 years later. 600, 1,000 years later. Something about calves and gold. Verse 30, "On the following day, Moses said to the people, 'You have committed a great sin, but now I will go back up to the Lord, and perhaps I can secure expiation for your sin.' And Moses went back to the Lord. 'Oh, this people has committed a great sin by making themselves a god of gold. And yet, if it pleased you to forgive their sins, then do so. But if not, please blot me out of the book you have written.'" Moses said, "I take my stand with the people." And Moses is perfectly functioning as a priest. A priest stands between the people and God, trying to bring the people towards God, trying to bring God to the people, trying to bring them together. The identification of himself with his people, that has echoes as well. Something like that happened with Isaiah. And when the day comes, maybe we can talk about that. Now, let's see if we can see what's happening here. I've got about 2 minutes to bring this together. We're going to talk about this a little bit more next week and then get started looking at the specifics. There is nothing wrong with the law. The law is holy and pure. Your assignment is to go read Romans 7 because it explains it better than I can. The problem is not the law. The problem is me. And the problem is so deep that I am incapable of obeying the law, and yet if I don't obey the law, I'm going to die. The whole purpose of the law is to bring us to the point where we realize how deep our problems are. Until the law came, Paul says, I didn't realize what trouble I was in. I stand condemned before God as an incurable sinner. I have no hope of ever satisfying the demands of God's law by my own effort. I have no hope of ever working my way into heaven. Here's the law. All you have to do is obey the law and you'll be right with God. And I can't do it, and neither can you. What happens? At that point, you suddenly realize there has to be another way, or I and everybody around me is without hope. The purpose of the Ten Commandments is to show us how we should live. It is also to show us that without God's help, we can't live that way. Listen carefully, because I'm trying to draw the paradox back together. We cannot meet the demands of the law by our own efforts. There has to be another way. God has provided us with a Savior, not to simply say the law doesn't matter, but to say, I'm going to come alive in your heart in the form of the Holy Spirit, and I'm going to help you obey that law, because if you don't obey that law, you will die. The purpose of the Ten Commandments, the purpose of the law, is to give us that plumb line we talked about last week, to show us what the standards are, to help us understand we have no hope of meeting those standards on our own. There has to be another way. The law prepares us for what happened thousands of years later when Jesus came. We're standing on this side. We can see both pretty clearly if we look. But for the people of that time, it was still pretty dim. Now that's where we're going to start next time. We're going to look a little bit at that context of what the function of the law is, what it's trying to do. Then we're going to come back and look, because the Ten Commandments do matter. It does matter to understand what they're talking about. Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Our Father, we thank you for a new year. We thank you for the opportunities that come to do things better and differently. But no attempt on our part to do things better or differently is going to be successful if we don't do those things with your Holy Spirit guiding us and working inside of us. Help us understand how much we need you. Help us understand how much all of us together need you, so that here we can build a community of people encouraging each other, helping each other, because alone and apart from you, we don't have any hope at all. Help us recognize that you are awesome and fearful, but that you call us into a relationship. Your power and your love exist side by side. You are able, and you do love us. All this we pray in your Son's name. Amen.